Welcome to our regular Friday night closed meeting and also our 23rd anniversary of the Cosmopolitan Group of Alcohol Anonymous. Alcohol Anonymous is a friendship of men, women who share their experience, strengths, and hopes with each other that they may solve a common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sense of denomination, politics, organization, or institute, and do not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor imposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the preamble of Alcohol Anonymous. And it means just that if we have persons here for the first time or visit with someone, that is the introduction of this program. And we also have the 12 suggested steps, which I like to call to awaken to. And it's the customary of this group that at the beginning of each meeting, if we read these steps in unison, and if you will find a copy of these steps on the seats by you or near you, and if you will, please read them with me. Step one, we admit we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become unmanned. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Made a certain and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admit it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I will say good evening again. My name is Colonel M. Williams. It's a name, not a rank. By the grace of God, and try to practice the principles of this program to the best of my ability, I'm sober this evening. And to get on with the program, we have two speakers, and one of the members of the group, I don't know what it was, will read at this time the history of the Cosmopolitan Group. I will give you Bob.
Good evening, friends, and welcome again. And my name is Bob Yvonne, and I'm an alcoholic. As Colonel stated, my duty to read the brief history as we have been able to compile it of the founding of the Cosmopolitan Group. The story of the founding of the Cosmopolitan Group is an interesting one, which began 23 years ago. According to the story passed on to us, a member of the parent group, Charles, mentioned his interest and membership in AA to one of his insurance patrons, Mrs. Gant. His insurance patron, Mrs. Gant, with whom Jimmy Scott and his wife had lived. During this time, Jimmy was not well and decided to go to her, kept in touch with him, and knew that he was not getting any better. Finally, Jimmy returned to Washington, and Mrs. Gant was able to persuade him to do some part-time work for her. Taking advantage of this closeness, Mrs. Gant asked Jimmy if he would allow Charles to talk with him. Jimmy consented, and the contact was very successful. In April 1945, the first meeting of the Cosmopolitan Group was held at the YMCA with Charles, Jimmy, Viola, Mrs. Gant, and Mrs. Gant's brother, who was also having difficulty. Jimmy Scott began working with the alcoholic clinic at the Municipal Center. Here he met Ed Jones and Bernice, both of whom joined the Y group. Next to join was Henry and Bob, then Junius, and a Mrs. Marshall. The group then began to draw additional members from the alcoholic clinic at Polk School, 7th and P Street. The clinic had psychological therapy groups and allowed the members to talk freely with the patients. The psychiatrist was very cooperative, and the Cosmopolitan group began. After that, its growth was very rapid. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. And now, at this time, I would like to call on the secretary. And so I'm a last speaker. I've never heard him speak before. And I did hear something about a number. I'll let him explain that, because when you say numbers, that got it. I think I played a parlay of 70-70 day, and I think I hear somebody say a 9 to leave. So now I will give you my next speaker and the final speaker, Rob.
Thank you, Colonel. Bernice. I joined the AAs. My name is Raleigh Hemsley. And I was a professional baseball player. I played in the big leagues 20 years. 11 of them drunk, 9 sober. You people out there are very fortunate to learn about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to find out the hard way. Some of the drinking episodes I was on cost me quite a bit of money. And every time I was on an episode, I either had my picture printed in a newspaper, something like this, which you persons do not have. So you're very fortunate. I played with some great ball players. I played against Babe Ruth, Walter Johnson, Sam Rice, Joe Judge. I'll name some of them around here. Played against those fellows, and I played with Hack Wilson. Probably some of you have heard of him. He holds a record of 190 runs batted in. That's more than the Washington Ball Club hits in all year. But they tell me that the ball players are better today than they were back in 20 years ago. I started to drink back in about 1927. Up here at Frederick, Maryland. That's where I started my baseball career in 1925. I went to Pittsburgh in 28, 29, 30, 31, Chicago Cubs in 31 and 32. That's where I ran into Hack Wilson and Pat Malone. Some of you fellows might have heard of those fellows. Paul Wehner was one of my drinking partners at Pittsburgh. Then I can go on over to Cincinnati. But when I got to St. Louis Browns in 1933, seems like I was on my own. A manager named Roger Hornsby. Seems like every time I turned around, why, I run into Rod. And back in those days, we played all day ball, baseball instead of night. So we had a lot of times to drink and play around, which I didn't miss any of it. Some of the episodes I was on, I'll tell you about them. One of them I was down in San Antonio, Texas, in spring training, and we went to Laredo, Texas, which is on the border of the Rio Grande, right across from the old Mexico. We had an exhibition game scheduled, and it started to rain, and I was over in old Mexico, so when I got back to the hotel, the bus had left. Well, naturally, when I was over in Mexico, I sampled out some of the stuff that they made over there, tequila and some of the other drinks that they had across the bar. But when I really got back to the hotel, the bus was already on its way to San Antonio, which is about 150 miles, and I didn't have any way to get up there. So I had a few bottles in a bag that I got across the strip, across the river, and I started to drinking. Well, I finally hit into San Antonio about 7 o'clock that night, and before I went to the hotel, I went to a liquor store and got me a couple fists. And I don't know where I picked them up, but I had a girl on each arm when I walked into the hotel looking for Hornsby. And Don Barnes, who was the owner of the ball club, and Bill DeWitt, who was the general manager. Well, they saw what kind of a condition I was in, so they ducked me. They didn't want to have anything to do with me. But the next morning they did, because they called my room and told me to come up to Mr. Barnes's room. Well, I went up there, and when I came back out of there, I was $5,000 less than what I went in with, because that's what they fined me. So you people have little troubles. I used to have a lot of big troubles. Another episode was in 1935 at the World's Fair in Chicago. Mr. Hornsby, he was very grateful and gave the whole ball club the day off. But we had to catch a train that night to Detroit. Now, most of these fellows went out to see the fair. But I couldn't go by the bar, because that's where I spent my afternoon. And the time I hit the train, why, I had a snoot full. And the time I got off the train the next day in Detroit, I had two snoot full. Because that night on the train, we run into Ted Lewis and his band. Now, I don't know who drinks anymore, a ball player or a musician. And we really hit it up that night. When we hit Detroit the next morning, we're standing with a teammate of mine, Frank Ruby, was on the platform, and we were waving goodbye as the ball player was walking off in the train in the station. And in those days, we had to carry our own grips. Not like today, the kids are not strong enough to carry the grips, so they pick them up right at the ballpark and haul them, put them on the planes, and haul them, and even when they get back to the hotel, why, they take it up to each room. They have numbers on the suitcases. But we had to carry our grips. So when they went by, why, Groovy and I went back in the train and sat down and started to drink a little more, and we train pulled out into the yard and stopped. Well, I don't know which one of us come to our senses and said, well, we better get off in this train and stop. So we got our grips, started up through this yard about a mile, the railroad yard, and got a cab and went to the hotel. It was a book Cadillac hotel. And lo and behold, they had a revolving door there in the front of it. So neither one of us was very polite, so he went in one side and I went in the other. And we got locked in there. Anyway, we had to have the engineer come down and take the whole thing apart. Before the crowd of the people out on the sidewalk could get in, or the people upstairs wanted to get out. Well, after we got out, well, my roommate took me up to the room, and he saw what kind of condition I was in when I was in the revolving door, and he ordered up about 50 pounds of ice, and he cracked it up, and he put it in the tub, and put the water in. So when I got up there, he undressed me and put me in this tub and dashed me up and down to sober me up. Well, I was sober enough to go out to the ballpark that day, and when we got out there, Hornsby started to go around, and he asked different guys if they had a good time at the fair, and they said, yeah. And so he finally got to Groovy, and he said, Frank, did you have a good time at the fair? And he said, yeah. He said, well, it'll cost you $150. So then he asked a couple more, Sam West, Ray Pepper. Then he come to Raleigh. He said, Raleigh, do you have a good time? I said, yeah. He said, well, it'll cost you $300. I said, well, what the hell? I said, I wasn't twice as drunk as Groovy. Why should you fine me $300? Well, he said, I think you're twice as valuable to the ball club. That's the reason you're getting it. And it come out in the papers where I was fined and money taken out. I went to a meeting about 2 months ago, and somebody asked me how much it cost me in fines while I was playing baseball. And sitting down one night at home, nothing to do, I started to figure up the fines, the ones I could remember. And it come to almost to $20,000. So you see, I had to find out the hard way. Well, after four and a half years with the Browns under Hornsby, he had enough of me, and I had enough of him too, because every time I turned around, I was fine. So they sold me to Cleveland, and of course, when we went to Cleveland, they had more money than the Browns, and they trained right in New Orleans. And what a place for a ball club to train was down there. We're down there one night, and I went down on Bourbon Street. I didn't make all the bars, but I made quite a few of them. And I got in a fight. My right eye was closed, and the other one was going closed, so I couldn't make it out to the ballpark the next morning. Now, a photographer come up to my room. He found out I was in my room. And I went to the door when he knocked on the door and opened it. And he was out there with a camera. He was going to, I guess, take a picture of my bad eye. Anyway, I slammed the door and locked it and went back to bed. About a half an hour later, here comes the knock again. So I thought maybe somebody from the ball club was coming up to see how I was. So here was this same photographer going to snap my picture. So I started to close the door, and lo and behold, he pushed the door in and shoved me up against the dresser drawer, and he come on into my room. Now that's coming into my territory. So I picked out the drawer on the top of the dresser, and I set it right down over his head. I broke his camera. And boy, he went down that hall of flying. So when the club got through working out that day, well, Mr. Vitt, who was the manager there, he came in. He said, Raleigh, says, we're sending you back to Missouri. That was my home then, and suspended me for 10 days. So the headlines in the paper where I was on another tear, and I got the name of Rollick and Rollick. Because I was really going around. So I went when we got into Cleveland, I went back to spring training and drank a little bit and didn't get any more trouble. But when I got back to Cleveland, Mr. Slapnick called me up in the office one day and he said, "Raleigh, you want to quit drinking?" I said, "I certainly do." He said, "Well, we got a sanitarium out here on Euclid that can cure you in 3 days. I said, "Good, I'll go out there." And he said, "The ball club will stand the expenses." So I went out there, and the first night out there, I tried to get my clothes to get out of the place because they shot me in my chest. And come around every hour, every so often, and wake me up and give me a drink and ask me what kind I drank. I told them I drank anything I could get a hold of or get a kick out of. And that's white mule, gin, beer, scotch, wine, anything. So all night long, while they'd wake me up and they'd feed me a glass of gin and glass of bourbon, a glass of scotch. Then they'd come along and shoot me in the chest again, and every so often, about a half an hour, I'd get sick and go to the men's room and heave. So next morning, well, I told called Mr. Slapnick and told him I was going to get out of there. Well, he says, "You wait till I come out there." So he was out there in about a half an hour because he knew I was going to get out of there. So he talked me into staying and taking the treatment. By giving me $1,000 and a diamond ring. So I said, "Oh, well, I could stand anything for that." So, well, I said, "It's not going to help me, Slap." He said, "Well, stay here and try it." So I did. I stayed there, and lo and behold, when you get this glass of whiskey up to your nose and you would vomit, you was cured. That was their treatment. So, the end of the season, I happened to be hurt, and I was sitting up in the stands. Before I went up in the stands, I went up to the Slapnicker's office and got my check for $1,000 and a diamond ring and my last pay. Then I went up in the stands and I got drunk. So come contract time and the next spring, and Slap wasn't going to sign me up because I didn't keep my word. And I told him, I said, "Well, I did. I said I didn't get drunk anymore that year, baseball season." Anyway, I had to go back to Cleveland to Mr. Bradley to sign up. And that time they went to Fort Myers, Florida. So I behaved very good in Fort Myers. I stayed sober. We started north playing exhibition games with the New York Giants. And I hit Richmond, Virginia. We had Richmond and New York and then Cleveland. So coming out of Richmond, second baseman on the New York Giants, Alex Camporis, he had a bottle of old Granddad and asked me if I'd want a drink. And I said, "Oh," I said, "it might as well have a drink." So within a half an hour, I had two drinks there at the train. And when I got on the train, I had two fifths. So on the way north, the trainer of the ball club, him and I got in a fight, and I locked the porter in the men's room. I went out and I gathered up all the papers in that the fellows had been reading, and I threw them in an upper berth and I set fire to it. So they had to stop the train to put the fire out, and we arrived in New York the next morning. Went out to the ballpark, and Mr. Vitt says, "Raleigh," he says, "don't put on the uniform today." He says, Mr. Mumaw has a ticket for you to go back to Cleveland. So that was on a Saturday, Sunday morning, and it was a very lonesome ride for me going back to Cleveland with all that in the newspaper again, where I was suspended and sent home. Well, when I got into the Cleveland terminal that morning, why, Mr. Slapnick had met me at the top of the stairs, and I just thought, well, boy, here comes another good find. So he met me, and he took me over to the seat, and there was two gentlemen over there by the name of Bill Jones and Lloyd Tate. And they stood up, and I shook hands with them, and they said, Raleigh, do you want to quit drinking? I said, well, ask Mr. Slapnick. I tried it last year. I said, nobody can help me. They said, we can help you. Well, I said, if you can, for God's sake, do it. Because I was on my last legs in playing professional baseball. So they say that we belong to a club that is called the Alcohol Anonymous. And I said, well, I never heard of that club. What kind of a club is that? And he said, well, it's a club. And if you want to quit drinking, why, we'll talk to you about it. So Mr. Slapnick arranged the meeting for us that afternoon down at the ballpark, and we met down there. And Slap asked me, he said, well, Raleigh, do you want to go and try this? And I said, I'll try anything, because, you know, I tried it last year, and I told you it wasn't going to work, and it didn't, because that winter out on the farm, I really got drunk. So they were the ball club was coming home to open up on a Tuesday. And of course, I had to be there because Bob Feller was going to pitch, and I had to catch Feller. I was his catcher for the. So Slap said, well, he said, Raleigh, he says, you stay here 3 days with the ball club, and then they'll go on the road for 4 days. And when they come back, why, you'll be all right. I said, well, how are we going to arrange it? And he said, well, the last time up at bat, when you go to first base, why, trip over first base and fake a sprained ankle. Well, I said, well, what if I strike out? And he said, well, when you go back to the dugout, fall in it. But anyway, I had the ball to the shortstop and went down first base, and I faked the sprained ankle. So right after the ball game was over, why, Mr. Slapnicker came down to the clubhouse and talked to Vitt and said, well, Raleigh's not going to help you on the ball club. You're only gone 4 days. Why, just leave him here and we'll have him treated here. He didn't say for what, but he said, we'll have him treated. So next morning, these two fellows, Bill Jones and Lloyd Tate, I was really a drunk because I had to have two sponsors come and got me at the hotel and took me down to Akron, Ohio, and that's 40 miles from Cleveland. And I met Dr. Bob Smith, who was the originator of the Alcohol Anonymous, him and Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson was the other one. So I went into the hospital and met Dr. Bob, and he says, Raleigh, he says, what the hell are you doing here? And I said, well, I don't know. But these two fellows here says that you can help me with my alcohol problem. Well, he says, I believe I can, because I'm one of them. So they put me in bed, and he asked if I wanted to drink, and I said, no. I said, I came here to stop, and I says, I don't want it. He says, well, if you can stand it, why, more power to you. And I said, I'll stand it. So anyway, he'd come in, and he'd sit there and talk to me and told me some of the things that he did when he was drinking. Bill Wilson, he was a traveling salesman. He'd lock himself in a room for a week at a time.
supposed to be out making calls. Well, he wasn't. And Loy Tate was the sailor. And every time his ship would leave port, he'd have enough on him on the ship to last him until he hit the next port. So some of you fellows probably were like I was. You're just small drinkers compared to some of them that went through it. And while I was in the hospital, I think the 4 days I was there, there were, I'd say, about 40 of the members of the AA came and talked to me. Some of them had come and talked to me at 3 o'clock in the morning because they knew that I would be there. Then others would come in the morning or 7 o'clock in the morning. Any hours that they were going by the hospital, they would stop them and tell me their story, that they had of licking the problem of alcohol. There was one gentleman I'll never forget. He was a professor of Kent College. They had him in the nut house there in Ohio. And when he told me his story of like Bernice hiding hers into the coal bin, why, he hid his in the flowers, and he hid it every place just where he could get it after he was in the hospital. He had friends that bring it in to him, and he finally went nuts. So after listening to stories for about 4 days of these people and reading the red book, the Alcohol Anonymous, with stories in it, I said to myself, well, if they could quit drinking, I can quit drinking. So went back the next day, or 4 days later, went back and joined the ball club. And I had a pretty good year that year. I think I had around 290, which today is fabulous, because if you hit 190, well, you'd go up and ask for a raise. But I caught about 140 some ball games. And I think my fielding average was 994. I made 4 errors that year. And today, one player will make 4 errors in 1 game. So there are better ball players today than they are when I played. Anyway, I went through the year and had a good year and stayed sober and went out on the farm. And that was my tough part, to go out on the farm and stay sober out there, because that was my retreat in the winter. I'd go out there. I used to go out and get drunk, and I had about 30 dogs that I had. I used to go fox hunting and take these dogs out, turn them loose, and then get drunk. And I'd be out there for 2 or 3 days. My wife didn't know where I was at, but I had one old dog that she'd go home because she'd get hungry. And my wife would follow her back. Now, that's the way they used to find in the winter. So that winter I went out and I stayed sober and got along just fine. I didn't go to any meetings that winter, but during the summer back in Cleveland, every Wednesday when I was in Cleveland, why, these two hound dogs would come and pick me up after a ball game and take me down to Akron. And we'd go to meetings down there every Wednesday night. And you people are fortunate. You've got maybe 2 or 3 blocks to go, or maybe 10 blocks to go, because now I hear there's a group on almost every corner here in Washington. So all you have to do is go to these meetings and you'll find a lot of friends around, and the goodwill that they'll help you. If you've got trouble, they'll help you. But out there on the farm, I had to fight it out myself, which I did. And I went to spring training the next year. And, you know, newspaper people are nosy when you're in the limelight, because
Every time I'd go into a bar, I could see one of them sticking their head around to see whether I was taking a drink. Well, I was taking a drink, all right, but it was Coca-Cola. Because I felt this way. If I was afraid to go into a bar where they were drinking, then I wasn't cured. So I'd go into the bars with these fellows, and they'd have their Tom Collins and Whiskey Sours and Scotch and on the rocks and this and that, and I'd have Coca-Cola. And every once in a while, I'd go to the men's room. When I come back and I'd start a drink, one of these smart guys had poured a drink into my Coca-Cola, wanting me to get started again. Well, I tasted whiskey, but I spit it out. I never swallowed it. So, all spring training, these newspaper men were following me, and we went into Chicago. I think it was on opening day, April 9th, 18th, or the 16th, I think, to be the correct date. And Bob Fowler pitched a no-hitter. Now, if you're going to celebrate, that's a good time to celebrate when you catch a no-hitter. And I was fortunate. I drove in the winning run. We beat Chicago 1-0 that day. So these smart newspaper men knew I was going to take a drink and celebrate. Well, they saw me go into the bar, and right away they run to Oscar Vitt and said to Vitt, "Well, Raleigh's in the bar again." Well, he says, "When the explosion comes, I know he's come out." Well, I didn't explode or I didn't drink in there, but some of these fellows come up to me. There was Cobbledick and McCauley and Gibbons and Whitey Lewis. And they asked me, "What's the matter? I must celebrate." And I said, "I'm celebrating." And he said, "Yeah, but you're not drinking." I said, "Oh, I stopped drinking a year ago." You fellows didn't know that, did you? Well, he said, "How do you stop?" And I said, "Well, you meet me here in the morning, and I'll tell you." He said, "What time?" If I'd have said 5 o'clock, all four of them would have been there. And I said 8:30, so I got down a little early, about 8 o'clock, and here all four of them were sitting out there waiting. So I told him, I said, "Well, last year I joined the AA. And I'll never forget Ed McCauley." He says, "What the hell is AA? And I said, "Well, that's the Alcohol Anonymous." And he says, "Where did you join?" So they asked me a million questions. And I finally told them I joined down in Akron. It was a group of goodwill. And they said, "Well, how's it work?" And I said, "I don't know how it works, but it's working." And I said, "I'm satisfied." So when we got back to Cleveland, that's the first time it was made public. Nobody had ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous before in the paper. I was the 77th member of the group. I am the 77th member. Put it that way. Now, that group was started in 1935 by Bob Smith and Bill Wilson. And between 35 and 39, there were 76 members in it. But in 1940, the end of 40, I guess there was thousands, because I got a lot of letters, I got a lot of calls, and I went out personally on a lot of them, and a lot of others I turned over to the members of the AA who were in the group that went down to Akron with me. I'll never forget one night about 3 o'clock, there was a lady called me and asked me to come over and talk to her son. I said, "What's the matter with him? Does he have a drinking problem?" "Oh, yes, he does." I said, "Well, how bad is it?" "Why, he took his first beer tonight." I said, "Lady," I said, "would you mind going back to sleep and leave me alone?" But I really got some dandy calls. You know, you can't go out and pull somebody into AA. They wanna have to come in themselves. They gotta have a desire to quit. And if anybody has a desire to quit, AA can help them. Because they've helped me, and they've helped millions of other people. Now, I think when I went in 1939, there were two groups. There was one little group in New York and the one in Accra. And I think today I'd vouch to say there's tens of thousands of groups all over the United States. Because I would get letters wherever I went. I'd get telephone calls when I went to Chicago or Detroit, and people would call me up about drinking problems. And that's the reason I said some of you people are fortunate, because you have a group here on every corner. You don't get your names in the paper. You don't get fined. Oh, a little fine, maybe $50 for being drunk. That's nothing. But one thing I don't like about AA is the way they announce each other, Charlie C. or John J. or I'm proud of my name. I belong to the Alcohol Anonymous, and I think everybody should be. If you had hay fever, you would go to a doctor and get cured. So if you have alcohol problems, go to the AA and they'll cure you. But you shouldn't be ashamed of your name, because that's the only one you'll ever have. The men anyway. The women might have to. So I believe speaking up for the AA, and it's been years that I was like a lot of people, that I didn't want people to know that I belonged to the AA, so I stayed undercover.
But I'm very happy to be invited down here to the 23rd anniversary. And I'm very proud to meet Denise up there, being on it for that long. And as she said before, if you can't lick it, there's a power greater than we are that can help you. And you don't make up your mind to quit for a year. I've been on it for 29 years. I had my birthday April the 16th. And I live from hour to hour.